This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Welcome to the Culture Hour. This is Barb. I'm reading from the Week magazine dated March 8, 2024. Let's find out what's going on, the main stories and how they were covered. Ceasefire talks stumble as Rafah assault looms. What happened? As ceasefire talks between Israel and Hamas continued, the Israeli military this week submitted a plan to the Israeli War Cabinet for a ground assault on the southern city of Rafah, where some 1.5 million displaced Palestinians are sheltering. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Israel was determined to wipe out the remaining Hamas command centers in the tunnels under the city. But Rafah is the only point of entry for aid to Gaza, and aid agencies said invading it would be catastrophic. A two-month-old baby in Gaza City died of hunger this week, and more than 500,000 more Palestinians are at risk of starvation. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said an assault on Rafah would be the nail in the coffin for Gaza. President Biden raised hopes that the invasion would be delayed or averted, saying he was optimistic that a ceasefire deal would soon be reached. Negotiators from the U.S., Israel, Qatar, and Egypt met in Paris and Qatar this week to discuss such a deal, which would involve trading 40 Israeli hostages for 400 Palestinian prisoners. Biden said Israel had agreed in principle to halt fighting during the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, which starts March 10th. But Hamas said a deal was not close, while Netanyahu said that even if a temporary ceasefire is reached, the Rafah invasion will proceed as soon as it ends. He also said Israeli forces would remain in Gaza as long as necessary to fully disarm Hamas so that the Palestinian militant group could not launch another attack like the October 7th massacre that started the war. What the columnist said, Netanyahu's plan for after the war is a blanket rejection of any solutions that empower the Palestinians, said Ishan Tharoor in the Washington Post. He's opposed to the Palestinian Authority taking over in Gaza, even as the PA leadership resigned this week to show its willingness to reform, and opposed to any discussion of a Palestinian state. He even announced new Israeli settlements in the West Bank right after the Biden administration changed U.S. policy and called such settlements illegal. Biden's proposals are worse, said Seth Cropsey in National Review. His grand bargain envisions a Palestinian state in return for an Israeli-Saudi reapproachment, effectively rewarding Palestinians for Hamas murder spree. Netanyahu is right that eliminating Hamas completely as a military threat is Israel's only option. The most likely result of the Biden administration's faux shuttle diplomacy isn't a stable settlement, but a rupture between Israel and America. We now have a toxic combination of thousands of civilian casualties and a Netanyahu peace plan that promises only endless occupation, said Thomas Friedman in the New York Times. The sympathy given to Israel in the immediate aftermath of the Hamas attack is being replaced by rage. Yet Netanyahu, facing numerous corruption trials, appears ready to sacrifice Israel's hard-won international legitimacy so he can stay in power. As the world watches Palestinian children get blown apart by U.S.-supplied weapons, America's global standing may plummet right along with Israel's. Social media laws face Supreme Court scrutiny. What happened? Both conservative and liberal justices this week expressed skepticism about two state laws regulating social media in a pair of cases that could transform how the First Amendment applies to online communication. During arguments in Moody v. NetChoice and NetChoice v. Paxton, they asked whether laws passed in Florida and Texas in 2021 would require unconstitutional government-compelled speech. Florida's Stop Social Media Censorship Act prohibits platforms from banning political candidates or journalistic enterprises, while Texas HB 20 bars them from blocking or otherwise penalizing content based on its viewpoint. attorneys for the Republican-led states argued the laws are designed to prevent censorship by social media companies. Chief Justice John Roberts countered that what private companies choose to limit is not a First Amendment concern. What the government's doing here is saying, you must do this, you must carry these people. He said, that's not the First Amendment. Most of the justices, however, appeared wary of striking down the laws entirely, as lawyers for NetChoice, a trade group that includes Meta, Google, and TikTok, sought. Though lower court injunctions have halted enforcement, they are broad enough to cover tech companies with less clear-cut First Amendment interests. Florida's law, Justice Amy Coney Barrett said, looks to me like it could cover Uber. It looks to me like it could cover Google's search engine. The justices may leave it to lower courts to determine the law's true scope. A decision is expected by late June. What the columnist said, though social media companies' censorship tilts against conservatives, that still doesn't justify government coercion, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Texas and Florida's lawyers argued that these platforms act like a common carrier, such as the telephone company, but they are more like a newspaper, exercising editorial judgment in curating content to keep advertisers from fleeing. The Texas law especially is so sweeping it could be read to bar platforms from suppressing pro-Nazi speech. Don't compare the social media platforms to newspapers, said Tim Wu in the New York Times. They hold themselves out as a place for anyone to connect with the world, then turn around and seek a kind of immunity verging on sovereignty with potentially dire consequences. They want to hijack the concept of free speech and make it into their own broad cloak of protection that would hobble our ability to regulate everything from data privacy to AI-generated content. The justices are clearly bothered by these incompetently drafted laws, said Ian Millhiser in Vox. They're so broadly drawn that it's hard to identify which parts, if any, could be constitutional. The Supreme Court could send this back to lower courts to work that out, though Barrett suggested the court could write an opinion that states explicitly that many of the law's applications are unconstitutional. If any part of the law stands, it means a bonanza for lawyers and confusion for everyone else. What a mess. Controversy of the week, Ukraine. After 2 years of war, is victory possible for Kyiv? The mood in Ukraine is about as gloomy as it has been since Russia launched its full-scale invasion 2 years ago, said Charlie Dagata and Steve Berryman in CBSNews.com. The war's second anniversary landed just days after one of Kyiv's toughest losses so far. The fall of the eastern city of Avdiivka, taken by Russia after months of bombardment. Russian forces are now probing west, flush with weapons and materiel from a revitalized defense industry. Ukraine, meanwhile, is running out of ammunition, said Mark Santora in the New York Times, and facing the once unthinkable prospect of waging a long war without American military backing. In the war's early days, buoyed by Ukraine's success, President Biden pledged to supply aid and weapons for as long as it takes to drive out Russian troops. But 2 years and $75 billion later, the lack of military progress is eroding U.S. public support for Kyiv. About 50% of Americans now oppose further aid to Ukraine, including a majority of Republicans. And $61 billion in desperately needed military aid remains stalled in Congress, blocked by the increasingly isolationist House GOP. As Ukraine's fight for survival enters its third bloody year, the forecasts are anything but optimistic. Ukraine faces steep challenges, said Lawrence D. Freeman in Foreign Affairs. But this also remains an incredibly difficult war for Moscow to win. The Battle of Avdiivka cost the lives of up to 47,000 Russian soldiers, all to recapture a city now battered beyond habitation. If Russia persists with this strategy, wasting lives for meager territorial gains, it will get harder for Russian President Vladimir Putin to hide the futility of the whole enterprise from his people. Moscow's military losses in Ukraine are already more than four times what the old Soviet army sustained during a decade of war in Afghanistan, said Daniel R. DePetris in MSNBC.com. Some 315,000 personnel have been killed or wounded, more than 90% of Russia's pre-war army, and a third of Russia's Black Sea naval fleet has been disabled. Ukraine's odds of victory may have dimmed, but Russia is losing too. Putin doesn't care about the cost, said Joe Buccino in The Hill. Unlike Western politicians or Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, he can pursue his war effort unshackled by the whims of democracy. With victory assured in this month's sham elections, Putin knows he can keep pouring money and troops into Ukraine for longer than the West can sustain the will to oppose him. Eventually, the spigot of international aid will close, sealing Ukraine's fate. Then there's the matter of Donald Trump, said John Bacon in USA Today. The prospect that this Putin admirer, who has open disdain for international cooperation, could win a second term thickens the ominous cloud over Ukraine's future. Ukraine can still win, said Ella Sherman in Business Insider, if its troops dig in and hold off Russian advances this year. That could buy time for Kyiv to rearm, while attrition take its toll on Russian troops. In early 2025, Ukraine could potentially negotiate a lasting peace with Russia from a position of strength. Such a settlement may not look like the victory some maximalists have been promising, said Keith Gessen in The New Yorker, but the alternative is the outright Russian victory that seemed imminent 2 years ago. That would have catastrophic consequences for the people of Ukraine and for the West. If a vengeful Putin sees that his dreams of imperial expansion are becoming reality, what will he do next? Only in America. The National MS Society has apologized for firing a 90-year-old volunteer who was confused by colleagues' use of pronouns in email signatures. Californian Frank Itkoff had worked for the Multiple Sclerosis Charity for 60 years, but was asked to step down in January for breaching its diversity and inclusion policy after she asked why people were adding she, her, and he, his, to their messages. Following public backlash, the nonprofit apologized, saying it should have had more conversations with Fran. A Missouri lawmaker has introduced a bill that would let pregnant women get divorced in the state. Missouri is one of four states, along with Texas, Arkansas, and Arizona, that bar judges from signing divorce papers if one party is pregnant, even if the woman is a victim of domestic violence. Democratic State Rep. Ashley Ahn said the ban doesn't make sense in 2024. In other news, top lawmakers agree on deal for stopgap funding. Congressional leaders announced this week that they had struck a short-term deal to avert a partial government shutdown on March 1st. Initially proposed by House Speaker Mike Johnson, the agreement would fund some federal agencies through March 8th and others through March 22nd. The agreement, which would be the fourth stopgap spending measure passed in recent months, sets up potential votes next week on six of the 12 annual spending bills. Johnson is expected to need the support of Democrats to push the stopgap deal through his chamber, where he has faced intense pressure from the GOP right flank to slash spending. House Freedom Caucus Chair Bob Good, Republican Virginia, said he was disappointed by the deal, denouncing the measure as more of the same. It was a good week for growing a pair after Israeli scientists working with cells extracted from mice reported they had successfully created a pair of laboratory testicles, raising the prospect of future breakthroughs in male infertility treatments. It was a good week for inflation gauges after a new poll found that the Tooth Fairy has cut its payouts for the first time in 5 years, leaving children an average of $5.84 per lost tooth, a 6% drop from 2023. It was a good week for water sports after record rainfall temperatures. temporarily revived an ancient lake in Death Valley, giving tourists a rare opportunity to splash around in the driest place on Earth. "This is the first time I've ever kayaked in my life," said Pat Anderson, 73, a visitor from Utah. "And to say I did it in Death Valley is hilarious." It was a bad week for plate appearances after Major League Baseball players expressed mounting concern over the league's new sweat-wicking Vapor Premier uniforms, which become, in the words of the Wall Street Journal, essentially sheer under bright lights. It was a bad week for keeping it together after a Las Vegas man arrested on suspicion of DUI lent weight to those suspicions by urinating on the leg of the arresting officer. Frank Afoa now faces multiple charges, including unlawful acts related to human excrement or bodily fluid. It was a bad week for pure imagination. After children were left in tears by a $44 a ticket Willy Wonka-themed immersive experience in Scotland, rather than the candy-filled Wonderland promised in ads, guests found a sparsely decorated warehouse that some likened to a meth lab. It wasn't all bad. Kevin Ease was 10 and playing in the Little League All-Star Baseball game when he noticed that he was seeing double. His parents took him to the hospital, and the doctors discovered he had a brain tumor that needed immediate surgery. Philip B. Storm, his surgeon, treated him quickly, and Ease was playing ball again in a week. The kid and the doctor kept in touch, and 14 years later, Ease is working as a clinical research assistant for the doctor who saved his life and plans on a medical career. Storm says that he brings unique skills because he can relate to what families are going through. After 52 years, Paul McCartney has been reunited with his cherished Hofner bass guitar, stolen from a Beatles touring van in London in 1972. In 2018, a group of Beatles fans launched the Lost Bass Project, an endeavor to trace an instrument featured on the group's first two albums. Tracking over 100 leads, the group discovered that the thief sold the guitar to Ronald Guest, a London pub owner, and suspected that the Guest family still retained ownership of the bass. In September, after the project was featured in a news article, a person in southern England reached out to McCartney's company and gave back the instrument. Despite a little bit of damage, the Hofner bass remains completely playable. Ashwath Kaushik last month became the youngest chess player to defeat a chess grandmaster in a classical tournament game. The prodigy, at age 8 years, 6 months, and 11 days, beat Jacek Stopa, 37, in the fourth round of Switzerland's Burgdorfer Stadthaus Open, 18, and finished 12th in the tournament. Born in India and now living in Singapore, Ashwath started playing chess when he was 4, and in 2022 became the world under-8 rapid champion, a meteoric rise. In the future, he would like to become a world champion. "It's surreal, as there isn't really any sports tradition in our families," said Kaushik Sriram, Ashwath's father. The U.S. at a glance. Madison, Wisconsin. Dirty money. Donald Trump's fundraising arm took part in a scheme to flout campaign finance laws in an effort to defeat one of the former president's political enemies, the bipartisan Wisconsin Ethics Commission said last week. The panel recommended that prosecutors pursue felony charges against Trump's Save America Committee and multiple GOP officials. The investigation centered on the 2022 GOP primary race between Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, whom Trump attacked for refusing to say that Democrats stole the 2020 election, and a Trump-backed challenger, Adam Steen. Voss narrowly defeated Steen, who, according to the panel, had told Trump's committee and other backers to circumvent a $1,000 cap on giving by donating to GOP county parties, which could give an unlimited amount. One county gave Steen more than $40,000. The county's GOP chairman was recorded telling Steen he could help wash that money. Owosso, Oklahoma. Bullying, death. the death of a non-binary teen who described being beaten up in a public school bathroom fueled outrage last week among those who say anti-LGBTQ policies are endangering queer youth. Relatives of Nex Benedict, 16, said the child was bullied for being non-binary in a state where children are legally defined by their sex assigned at birth and must use bathrooms that match that definition. Police resisted calling Benedict's death a homicide, however, saying a preliminary autopsy suggested trauma was not the case. The day of the fight, Benedict's grandmother took Benedict to the hospital for facial bruises and scratches, later expressing outrage that the school hadn't called an ambulance or police. The school's resource office visited Benedict at the hospital, and body camera footage shows the teen describing how they blacked out after three girls got me on the ground and started beating the shit out of me. Benedict collapsed and died a day later. Athens, Georgia. Migrant murder charge. A Venezuelan immigrant was arrested last week in the high-profile death of a nursing student who was found dead in the woods after going for a jog on the University of Georgia campus. Lakin Hope Riley, 22, a student at nearby Augusta University, died from blunt force trauma to the head, a coroner said. And the next day, police arrested Jose Antonio Ibarra, 26, who stands charged with felony murder. Ibarra crossed the U.S.-Mexico border illegally in 2022 and was released with temporary permission to stay in the country. Venezuela has generally refused permission for the U.S. to send back migrants. Republicans, including former President Trump, pounced on the murder to attack President Biden's border policies, which Georgia Governor Brian Kemp said have turned every state into a border state. Ibarra is accused of dragging Riley's body to a secluded area to conceal the death. Investigators have yet to identify a motive. Washington, D.C., changing of the guard. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell surprised colleagues this week by announcing he plans to step down in November from the leadership post he's held since 2007, making him the longest-serving Senate leader in U.S. history. McConnell, 82, said he was influenced by the death of his sister-in-law. He also suffered a fall last year, then had two alarming public freeze-ups. Beyond that, McConnell's once strong grip on his party has been slipping. The House GOP refuses to take up the recent Ukraine aid package that he passionately championed, and since he rejected former President Trump's claim that the 2020 election was stolen, the two haven't spoken in years. I have many faults. Misunderstanding politics is not one of them, McConnell said on the Senate floor, saying he plans to serve until 2026. I still have enough gas in my tank to thoroughly disappoint my critics. The world at a glance. Brussels. Farm protests turn filthy. Belgian farmers sprayed liquid manure on the streets of Brussels this week, set tires aflame, and clashed with police in Europe's latest protest against agricultural policy. For months, farmers from France to Poland have been using tractors to snarl traffic in major cities and block border crossings, complaining that new EU-wide environmental policies and competition from non-EU countries like Ukraine are driving them into bankruptcy. The Belgian demonstration took place as EU agricultural ministers met to discuss farmers' demands. We produce the food and we don't make a living, Morgan Odie of the farming group La Via Campesina told CNN.com. Why is that? Because of free trade agreements, because of deregulation. St. George's, Grenada, yacht attack. A Virginia couple were feared dead this week after their yacht was found empty off the coast of Grenada. Retirees Kathy Brandel and Ralph Hendry had been spending the winter sailing the Eastern Caribbean and were last seen near a Grenadian beach. Grenada police said they believe that three men who had recently escaped from prison hijacked the boat, killed its owners, and dumped their bodies in the ocean. The escapees have since been rearrested. The boat itself was ransacked and everything was strewn about in the entire cabin. So clearly there was an altercation of some type, the couple's son, Nick Burrow, told CNN.com, saying the family maintained a sliver of hope that the two might be alive. We are doing our best to try to get answers. Kabul. Taliban release prisoner. A far-right Austrian man imprisoned in Afghanistan for 9 months was freed this week after mediation by Qatar. Herbert Fritz, 84, was arrested by the Taliban last May on suspicion of spying. The Austrian newspaper Der Standard said the anti-immigration extremist, a founder of Austria's now-banned National Democratic Party, had traveled to Afghanistan to prove that it was safe under Taliban rule and that Afghan migrants should not qualify for asylum in Austria. He was arrested soon after getting his article, Vacation with the Taliban, published in a far-right magazine. I think it was bad luck, but I want to visit again, he said, after being released to Qatari custody. People in the news. Taking the stand in a Manhattan court this week, Eagles co-founder Don Henley expressed regret over his 1980 arrest when police entered his Los Angeles mansion and found cocaine, quaaludes, and marijuana and a 16-year-old prostitute who'd suffered an overdose. Henley, now 76, said the band's breakup months earlier had left him intensely depressed, and so he'd called a madam to arrange company. He said he hadn't known the girl was underage, but I know there was no sex. Henley pleaded no contest in 1981 to a misdemeanor charge of contributing to the delinquency of a minor. The testimony came after the trial of three collectors accused of scheming to sell stolen handwritten drafts of songs from the Eagles' 1976 album Hotel California, including the iconic title track. Henley said his drafts were stolen by a biographer in the late 70s. The defendants cited his arrest as evidence of Henley's poor judgment at the time, claiming he voluntarily handed the papers to the author. Former daytime talk show host Wendy Williams is suffering from alcohol-related dementia, her son said in a new Lifetime documentary. Where is Wendy Williams chronicles the many health problems that caused Williams, 59, to lose her long-running show in 2022. The documentary shows her spending days in bed surrounded by bottles of booze, struggling with memory loss, and crying as she explains that she's lost almost all feeling in her visibly swollen feet. Her son, Kevin Hunter Jr., says doctors told him she was drinking so much it was starting to affect her headspace and her brain. Shortly before the documentary aired, other family members said Williams had been diagnosed with frontotemporal dementia, and the language disorder aphasia. Supermodel Gisele Bündchen was spotted kissing fellow Brazilian Joaquin Valente while out in Miami last week after spending months denying that she was dating the hunky jiu-jitsu instructor. Bündchen and Valente were spotted vacationing in Costa Rica in late 2022, just 2 weeks after she finalized her divorce from NFL legend Tom Brady, with whom she has two children. Brady, who is now in a relationship with model Irina Shayk, suspects the pair started dating as early as mid-2021, reports the Daily Mail UK. Tom and Joaquin are not friends, a source said, but Joaquin is around his kids, so Tom has to find the good in him. Obituaries. The activist who blunted the stigma of AIDS. Hydea Broadbent, 1984 to 2024. Hydea Broadbent had no choice but to be brave. Diagnosed with HIV at age 3, she wasn't expected to live past 5, doctors told her adoptive parents. The disease, which soon developed into AIDS, made her vulnerable to life-threatening infections, and in the 1980s, the stigma around it was so great that a kindergarten teacher sprayed Broadbent with Clorox when she sneezed. Broadbent, who died last week at age 39, began speaking publicly about the disease at 6, and in 1992 appeared on a Nickelodeon special with basketball star Magic Johnson, who had recently revealed he was HIV positive. I want people to know that we're just normal people, Broadbent 7 told Johnson through tears. She soon became one of the most prominent HIV/AIDS activists, appearing on Oprah, Good Morning America, and other talk shows. I can do anything I put my mind to, the then 11-year-old said in an address to the 1996 Republican National Convention. I am the next Maya Angelou. I might even be the first woman president. I am the future, and I have AIDS. Broadbent was born in Las Vegas to a mother who was denied custody because of her drug addiction, said the Washington Post. With her adoptive parents, the young Hydea made frequent trips to the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, where she became one of the first pediatric patients to receive AZT and other pioneering antiretroviral drugs. There, the vivacious Hydea caught the attention of Elizabeth Glazer, founder of a pediatric AIDS foundation, said the New York Times. Glazer asked Broadbent's family if they would let Hydea speak publicly, something the youngster was eager to do. I started speaking out because a lot of my friends were not public with the fact they had HIV/AIDS, she said in 2012. They hid in secrecy. As an adult, she questioned the way she had been thrust into the spotlight, said the Wall Street Journal, saying her many public appearances meant that she missed out on doing kid things. Broadbent's last few years were hard, as COVID eliminated many of her speaking opportunities. But she continued to work tirelessly to thwart the spread of AIDS, urging young people toward abstinence or safe sex. I feel like I'm really blessed, she said in 2012, but at the same time, my life doesn't have to be their life. The Nobel scientist who feuded with his rivals, Roger Guillemin, 1924 to 2024. Roger Guillemin spent much of the 1960s processing more than 2 million sheep brains. His grueling, federally funded research was part of a ferociously competitive race to isolate the hormones the brain releases to control the pituitary gland, which in turn guides the endocrine organs. Proving that the brain communicates through means other than electrical impulses was extraordinarily difficult, since the so-called releasing factors occur only in trace amounts. From all those sheep brains, Guillemin eventually isolated 1 milligram of the hormone that directs the pituitary to control the thyroid. That earned him a share of the 1977 Nobel Prize in Medicine and contributed to the development of birth control pills and cancer treatments. Every single one of these molecules, which we isolated with all these problems over the years, he said in 2013, are currently used in modern medicine. The discovery is equally remembered for the bitter rivalries it fueled, said the New York Times. After the French-born Guillemin completed medical school in Lyons, a chance meeting with Hans Selye, an expert on the body's reaction to stress, led him to the new field of neuroendocrinology. He worked in Montreal and then at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, searching for the brain's releasing factors, but after a decade, he had little progress to show. Guillemin persisted, said the Washington Post, partly because he was competing against a former partner, Andrew Shally. In violation of scientific practice, the men concealed data from each other and mocked each other's errors at conventions. An equal partner, I could be with him, Shally said in 1978, but he wanted me to be his slave. The two refused to share credit, but ended up sharing half of the Nobel, said the San Diego Union-Tribune. In 1970, Guillemin set up his own laboratory at San Diego's Salk Institute and developed another feud, this time with a former protege, Wiley Vail Jr., who founded a rival lab on the same campus. Guillemin and Vail each found the releasing factors involved in stress and growth, though Vail got to both first. Still, the two men eventually reconciled, and at Vail's 66th birthday in 2007, Guillemin quoted Freud in praising his younger rival. "Part of any son worth his salt," he said, "is planning the killing of the father he loves and taking his kingdom." Under the last word, this place breaks your heart every day. A family ranch in Arizona has become a gateway for desperate migrants entering the U.S., said Eli Soslow in the New York Times, and for cartels smuggling drugs across the border. Aravaca, Arizona. Jim Chilton, 84, had named the dirt roads and pastures on his land in honor of 4 generations of family cattle ranchers, but now he prepared to drive across his ranch on the U.S. border, unsure of what he might find. He packed a handgun in case he encountered more smugglers working with the Sinaloa cartel and bottles of water for the migrants he'd recently seen lost and dehydrated in the Sonoran Desert. Do you have your satellite phone? Asked his wife, Sue Chilton, 81. There was no cell service on most of the ranch and no other homes for several miles. I'll take it with me, but assume no news is good news, Jim said. His plan for the day was to survey three remote water tanks and locate a few lost cows, simple tasks in a place where everything had become increasingly complicated during the past several months. Chilton laid out a map of southern Arizona on the hood of his truck and showed his wife the route he planned to take across their cattle grazing land, an area three times the size of Manhattan, located on the outskirts of Aravaca. He traced his finger over a desolate mountain range across six canyons and down to the 5.5 miles of their ranch that ran along the U.S.-Mexico border in what had become one of the busiest corridors for a record wave of illegal immigration. The Chiltons had spent the past several years trying to unravel the mysteries of their own backyard as the situation worsened on their ranch. They discovered drugs and at least 150 smuggling trails on their grazing land, so they put up security cameras and offered to arm all five of their working cowboys. Those cowboys started to see groups of migrants stranded near the border, so the Chiltons installed water fountains in the desert to help keep people alive. Their security cameras recorded hundreds of men walking by each month in camouflage, so they testified before Congress and campaigned alongside Donald Trump for a wall, hoping it might slow the procession of people onto their ranch. But now more immigrants entering the country illegally were crossing the southern border than ever before. Recently, Border Patrol agents estimated that as many as 250 people each day were arriving on the remote corners of the Chiltons' ranch after being led across the border by paid guides working on behalf of the Sinaloa cartel. I'll be back in 5 or 6 hours, Chilton said. He waved to his wife and turned onto a dirt road headed south. Chilton descended into Chimney Canyon, where a few years earlier a Border Patrol agent came upon a group of drug smugglers and was shot 5 times. Chilton continued driving over a hillside, where he remembered hearing a child from Honduras screaming for help, and following that boy over to his mother, who was dying of complications from diabetes. He stopped to check a water tank in the shadow of the 32-foot-tall steel border wall that Trump built as president. One of Chilton's cowboys had been checking the same tank a few years back when smugglers jumped him and allegedly threatened to come after his family unless he started transporting drugs. The smugglers stuffed 44 pounds of methamphetamine into the cowboy's spare tire, and he made drug runs until the Border Patrol arrested him. Just when you think you've seen everything, this place still shocks you, Chilton said. He turned onto a rugged road that paralleled the border wall and drove a few more miles until he saw a campfire burning in the distance. He was on the most remote corner of one of the most remote ranches in America, but as he drove closer, he counted more than 45 people sitting near the fire. Children shouted in French. A woman prayed in Arabic. What in the world is going on? Chilton wondered. Brian Best, 64, recognized Chilton's truck and walked away from the campfire to flag him down. Best was a volunteer aid worker from Tucson, part of a group called Tucson Samaritans, and lately he'd been spending 2 days each week on the border road as the first and sometimes only American to greet immigrants entering the country illegally who were crossing in historic numbers. The border wall was now compromised every few miles by rope ladders, small tunnels, gaps awaiting construction, and new pathways cut every few nights by smugglers. One of them was a 3-by-3-foot hole that led to a patch of saguaro cactuses and mesquite trees on the Chilton Ranch. Best had watched cartel guides lead more than 170 people through that opening in the past few hours, including dozens of women and children who said they planned to seek asylum in the United States. They were fleeing civil war in Sudan, caste discrimination in India, starvation in rural Guinea, and organized crime in Albania. During the coronavirus pandemic, Trump invoked a public health rule called Title 42 that allowed agents to turn away migrants at the border. Over 3 years, the U.S. used Title 42 to turn back people more than 2.8 million times. But the Biden administration allowed Title 42 to expire last May, and border policy defaulted to the previous standard, which allows most asylum seekers to stay in America while their cases play out in the court system. Soon after, Best started running into large groups of migrants near the border wall that often included women and children from all over the world. Almost half came from West Africa or Asia. By late December, the Tucson sector of the Border Patrol was encountering almost 20,000 migrants in a single week, a 300% increase over the last year, and nearly 10 times as many encounters as in the average week in 2021. Best handed out granola bars as he watched a mother and her four-year-old draw smiley faces with sticks in the dirt. He handed out fruit and added wood to the campfire as a group of men from Guinea removed their socks to warm their feet. The men said they had pooled their life savings to fly from Istanbul to Bogota, Colombia, to Nicaragua. They had spent 12 nights sleeping in the Mexican desert before crossing the border with the help of cartel guides, who they said stole what little money they had left before pointing them through the fence. "Someone is coming to get us soon," one of the men asked Best in English. He replied that he hoped so, but he could not be sure. "This place breaks your heart every day," Best told Chilton. "They're exhausted, they're sick, they're confused, they're cold, and they just have to wait. How can this be our system?" The Chiltons had thought about selling. They had considered moving closer to friends in Tucson or grandchildren in Los Angeles, but Jim had been ranching since his father gave him a saddle at 5, and he had kept getting back on a horse even after he was bucked off and broke 4 ribs in his late 70s. For years, he thought he could overcome their border problems, too, if only the right people listened. He gave speeches at his church, took politicians on tours of his ranch, and celebrated the construction of Trump's wall. But parts of that wall remained unfinished, and other parts were riddled with gaps, and now the Border Patrol was preoccupied with the record number of asylum seekers at the border. Despite 3 decades of activism, he believed most of his ranch was less secure than ever. He had taken to monitoring the cameras he had hidden on 5 of the ranch's 150 smuggling trails, and now he opened his laptop and called Sue into the kitchen to review the motion-activated footage from the past several months. "This is mostly from down by the corrals in that nice little oasis," he said. "With the deer grass and the beautiful emery oaks," Sue said. "It looks like we have at least an hour of images," Jim said as he hit play. In total, the cameras had collected images of more than 1,000 people crossing on those 5 trails, a tiny sample of what the United Nations considers the largest global movement of displaced people since the 1950s, with millions fleeing gangs, economic collapse, and political instability around the world. "It's a multi-ring circus, never mind just 3, Sue said. "It's hard to watch, given all the possibilities," Jim said. Their house had been broken into 3 times. Once, all that was missing was food and apple cider. Another time, someone had stolen several guns. Sue watched the parade march across the screen and closed the laptop. "I already think about it," she said. "I dream about it. That's enough." She got up from the kitchen table, and Jim followed her to their circular bedroom, perched on a hill overlooking the ranch. They had installed 18 windows with views in every direction so they could watch their herd migrate across the desert and storms roll in from Mexico. "The skyline is our fence line," Jim liked to say, and for years they had found peace in their solitude. But now the sun was dropping over the mountains, and Jim looked into the dying light and wondered who might be out there. Another night, another few hundred people arriving on the back corner of the Chilton's ranch, and Fatma Ali stepped through a hole in the wall and sat on a rock to get her bearings. It was 36 degrees, colder than it had ever been back home in Chad. She saw a cow grazing in the distance. She saw a handwritten sign that said they were 22 kilometers from a border patrol station in Sasebo, Arizona. But their groups of 2 dozen Africans had already been walking for many hours and could walk no more. One of them had a high fever. One had twisted his ankle. One was a 2-year-old who hadn't eaten all day. And one was a pregnant woman from Sudan named Rania Mohammed, who clutched her stomach, lay down on an abandoned wooden pallet and slipped in and out of consciousness for a few hours until a Border Patrol van came over the hill. "She's dizzy because we walk so much," Ali told two Border Patrol agents. "She's sick and exhausted. She's pregnant and feeling lots of pain." Mohammed was already 9 months along, and the agents huddled to discuss their options while Ali held her hand and prayed with her in Arabic. "God will protect us," Ali told Mohammed in Arabic, which was a version of what Ali had been repeating to herself for the past 3 months, ever since her relatives pooled their savings so one member of the family could flee the abuses and abject poverty of their life in rural Chad. Ali had been chosen to go because she too was pregnant and because she had taught herself to speak English as a child by watching American cartoons. She boarded a flight to Istanbul and another to Bogota. She suffered a miscarriage somewhere between Nicaragua and Honduras. She was robbed in Mexico. After 52 days of travel, she had arrived in the United States with neither a destination nor a plan. The only people she knew in America were the half-dozen friends she had made on the migrant trail, one of whom was now lying on her back and writhing in pain on the Chilton's ranch. "Does she think she's in labor?" an agent asked Ali. "She's not sure," Ali said. She explained that Mohammed was anemic, and all three of her previous pregnancies had ended in C-sections. "Okay, we need to move," the agent said. He loaded Ali, Mohammed, and the two-year-old into the van and told the rest of their group to wait on the road until more agents could come get them. The van started off down the rugged road toward civilization, passing other migrants along the way. Dozens of them rushed toward the van to ask for rides, reaching for the windows and crying out for help. But the van kept moving until the headlights disappeared over a hill, leaving the ranch in the dark. Under making money, keeping a mortgage into retirement. Paying off your mortgage before retirement may be an outdated rule, said Martha C. White in the New York Times. For a growing number of older Americans, retaining a mortgage that is likely to outlive them makes good economic sense, if the mortgage rate is below 4%. Rather than scrounging a lump sum to pay off the loan upon retiring, some are determining that those funds could be better deployed, especially with the yields on ultra-safe financial instruments like certificates of deposit now topping 5% or higher. Not everyone agrees, however, that a mortgage is a prudent thing for people to carry into retirement. If a health crisis arises or the death of a spouse destabilizes their life or finances, the home could be jeopardized. Under business, the news at a glance. Kellogg's chief, let them eat flakes. The CEO of Kellogg's has a money-saving idea for Americans worried about the cost of food, said Emily Heil and Jacqueline Pizer in the Washington Post. Cereal for dinner. Chief Executive Gary Pilnick appeared on CNBC to tout the company's new marketing campaign, which suggests consuming bowls of Frosted Flakes and Rice Krispies as a fun way to shake up a family's dinner table routine. The ads don't actually recommend cereal for its cost savings, but Pilnick brought up his company's products as a more affordable alternative to your typical dinner fare, calling cereal a great destination when consumers are under pressure. His comments struck a nerve with people, many of whom likened them to Marie Antoinette's infamously heartless let-them-eat-cake line. Others wondered what Pilnick ate for dinner on the $4.9 million he earned last year. Notably, the cost of cereal has jumped more than 27% since the start of the coronavirus pandemic. It occurs to me that he thinks eating cereal for supper is a new idea. Under consumer, tip of the week, how to clean a lampshade. For paper, never get a paper shade wet. Instead, use a vacuum with a brush attachment or a soft brush or lint roller to remove any dust or debris. For fabric, remove dust in the same manner, tackling pleats with a clean paintbrush. Mix fabric detergent into a sink or tub of warm water and submerge the shade for 15 minutes. For stains, rub with a soft cloth. Drain the sink or tub and resubmerge the shade in clean water. Allow to air dry. To spot clean, A solution of dish soap and water can be used for spot cleaning, but first test an inconspicuous area to make sure cleaning won't leave a watermark. Follow up spot cleaning with a damp cloth to reduce soap residue. For glass and plastic, use a solution of dish soap and water and wipe the shade using a sponge. Rinse with clean water, then dry with a cloth to prevent water spots. Under film reviews, Ordinary Angels, directed by John Gunn, PG, 2 stars out of 4, a brash drinker turns miracle worker. The new faith-based tearjerker starring Hilary Swank overcomes seemingly insurmountable odds, said Siddhant Adalka in the Daily Beast. The modest hit begins, after all, as a mechanical, saccharine, fact-based drama about a young widower with an ailing daughter and the alcoholic hairdresser who barges into their lives to help them secure medical care. Swank gets the imperfect angel role, and she's saddled with a whole lot of function-first dialogue. Fortunately, the rest of the performance come to the rescue, starting with the story's two sisters and their roofer father, played by brawny Reacher star Alan Richson. Angels is one of those movies where you can predict developments with certainty, said Jocelyn Novak in the Associated Press. You know when Swank's do-gooder is going to relapse. You know when the call will come announcing that 5-year-old Michelle must rush to the hospital for her liver transplant. But Swank can lend truth to most any scenario. And for a good cry at the movies, that's really all you need. Besides, even if you could resist another spunky Swank performance, said Jen Yamato in the Washington Post, who among us can deny the sublime beauty of Jack Reacher's tears? Under music reviews, Beyoncé's country breakthrough. Beyoncé is riding high in her new country phase, said Christopher Kuo in the New York Times. The 42-year-old superstar made history last week by becoming the first black woman to top Billboard's Hot Country Songs chart. Texas Hold'em, the lead single of an album the Houston native will release on March 29th, was carried to the number one slot by streaming and sales demand, but was also gaining traction on radio, moving up to number 34 in the country airplay chart. With its two-step-worthy rhythm and the great Rhiannon Giddens on banjo, the 4-minute hit absolutely sounds like a country song, said Chris Melanfi in Slate. However, it's hard to know whether country fans are embracing it, because the song also hit number one on Billboard's pop chart, and the country chart derives from the same sales, streaming, and airplay data. Still, I am grateful the Queen is on that throne. It signals to those leery of genre trespassers that she belongs. Under health and science, exercise helps women more. Men have to do twice as much exercise as women to get the same long-term health benefits, a new study suggests. Researchers looked at data for 412,000 adults in the U.S., ages 27 to 61, who were followed for 2 decades. They found that every type of exercise measured, including running, cycling, and strength training, gave women a bigger health boost than men. Women who exercised regularly were 36% less likely to suffer from cardiac issues compared with those who didn't, while for men the difference in risk was just 14%. Whereas men had to do 5 hours a week of moderate aerobic exercise to cut their risk of premature death, women had to do only 2.5 hours. It was the same for vigorous exercise, such as running or cycling. Men had to do 110 minutes a week of vigorous exercise to get the same benefit that women got in just 57 minutes a week. The study didn't explore why women enjoy this advantage, but other research has shown that women have more capillaries in their muscles, which could allow more blood and oxygen to flow to the heart during exercise. Another possible factor is that women tend to exercise less overall, so they show greater gains from a lower baseline. Whatever the explanation, senior author Susan Cheng tells CNN.com the findings show that exercise is not a one-size-fits-all situation. It must be true, I read it in the tabloids. A Florida man who went to a Jacksonville hospital after months of worsening face pain and nosebleeds, had 150 live bugs removed from his nose. There was significant abnormality in that nose, said attending physician David Carlson, who found writhing insect larvae feeding on the man's sinus tissue right under the brain. It's not certain how they got there, but the patient suspects it was from handling dead fish on fishing trips. Before, I would rinse my hands in the river, he said. Now, I'll use cleaner. Plastic surgeons in New York City are seeing a boom in male patients who want their nipples to be reduced in size and made to look like soccer star David Beckham's. That means small, symmetrical, and almond-shaped. This is a thing, said Mark Everett, a plastic surgeon on Manhattan's Upper East Side. People want David Beckham's nipples. The procedure, which involves extracting breast tissue from under the nipples, cost about $5,000. Patients can return to work in an hour, said surgeon Eli Levine, who does the operation twice a month. It's definitely a growing trend, he said. A contractor renovating a bathroom in Seattle made an unexpected discovery while ripping out a bathtub, an old grenade between the studs. My first thought was to get out of there, said Vadim Karkavi, who, after catching his breath, returned for a closer look. I zoomed in on my phone, and I'm like, that's an actual freaking grenade. Police determined it wasn't live and told him it had probably been brought home by a World War II vet who stored it there and possibly forgot about it. Under wit and wisdom, speak when you are angry, and you will make the best speech you will ever regret. Ambrose Bierce. You never know what worse luck your bad luck has saved you from. Cormac McCarthy. You are not a drop in the ocean. You are the entire ocean in a drop. Rumi. If women were happy, the scented candle industry would tank. Once factual truth is no defense in politics, all that remains is spectacle and force. Timothy Snyder. The children are always ours, every single one of them, all over the globe, and I am beginning to suspect that whoever is incapable of recognizing this may be incapable of morality. James Baldwin. Thank you for listening.